We go. Very good. Good to see everybody. So we're on page 120. If you're using the Art Scroll translation, we're at 120A5. We're towards the bottom of the Daf. Kuf, Kaf, Amud Aleph, Matnitin. So as you remember, Matnitin is the word that introduces what in the Gemara? A Mishnah. So a Mishnah is going to come up, and the rabbis of the Mishnaic era are called Tanaim, and the Tanaim created the Mishnah, and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi edited it. And I remind us of the background of the Mishnah as a document, because the notion here is that the Mishnah, and this Mishnah is going to be, of course, involving itself with the fire that breaks out on the Sabbath, which is the perek we're in, right? A fire that breaks out on the Sabbath is at the heart and at the center of what it is we're dealing with. And the Mishnah is going to be dealing with a way to seemingly do something that we already established is absolutely asur. It's absolutely forbidden. So, of course, one question that one could ask about any kind of inquiry into something that is forbidden is, you know, wait a minute. How can they be saying this if already they said that putting out the fire is indeed absolutely forbidden? Michael, I believe that I have the volume from the Beit Midrash. That is the fourth volume of Tractate Shabbat. Could be that someone is not here and has the art scroll on the shelves that we could... I just want to use this as the teachable moment, right? So, I just said that somebody's Gemara on the shelf. Tomorrow's shelf could be used. I'm going to take this one. I don't need it. There's a principle in the Talmud. Zion, not a dollar. It's Chayin. La Adam. Shalom. So can you read it all? Zakain or Zakain le Adam shelo vifanav. So this word Zakain comes from the verb zoche. In yeshivish parlance, I could say to you, that is a word, by the way, yeshivish parlance. In yeshivish parlance, I could say to you, I should be so zoche. Means I should merit that. And lemezachiti is part of the davening in the morning. And what did I merit to actually deserve this, right? To make meritorious for a person that is not here, that is not before him. In other words, to make meritorious
something for a person when really it's not being done before him is a principle in the Gemara. So the fact that someone wouldn't come to class and have a book on the shelf, but that we would take it down and be able to use it, is this Talmudic principle. Now the irony is that over the centuries, you couldn't do that with a Gemara. Because if I have a book, right, imagine in the old world what that really represents. This represents somebody paying a lot of serious money for this book of folios and the stitching. And it's very valuable. But when the world of math publishing comes out, Jewish law changes. And books are as possible to fit into this category as things like talit and tefillin. You would think someone's talit and tefillin shouldn't go down in, on the rabbi's seat, right? Take my talit bag, open it up, just start putting my talit and tefillin on. Lahesech. Oppositely. You're all invited. Go downstairs, open my talit and tefillin bag anytime. Because actually this is the Talmudic principle of Zakin La'adam Shelo B'fanav. It's you actually allowed me the great merit of my talis and tefillin doing something very holy that both I would agree to if I was there, because I would have no right to even say, can't touch that. And secondly, that you would do that with my belongings would be attributed to me for good. So in the Beit Midrash, that's no small thing. In the Beit Midrash, we have such principles at work all the time. So these small actions and what we do are important by way of conceptual analysis in the whole panoply of Gemara Talmudic literature. So I point that out, and it's a nice way to be able to introduce the class, because the small act that I'm going to do regarding putting out a fire the small act I'm going to perform, the kind of approach I'm going to take for any given thing that happens has at its core the principle of what can the law inform me about? How does the law inform me? And it's a fundamental outlook of the tradition, and especially on Shabbat. What we've been saying, for those joining today, there's some some people haven't heard me say it as many times as others, and we know that they're trying to establish the Shabbat community. The sages in this Masechta are marketing the Sabbath as an ideal, as a way. And they're saying to people to come to the synagogues on the afternoon of Shabbat and listen to the drashot, to the hermeneutical approach to reading Torah and then creating law about Shabbat instead of sitting in your home and even reading other books of the Bible. They don't like that culture of your reading on your own. They want you to be in the reading community of the Torah. So A, they're trying to do Shabbat, and the piece that I thought about as I was looking at it this time around was they also want you to be a reader of the text like a rabbinic Jew. So they're inducting you into the textuality that they see and the space to create and craft law that is in response, yes, to the fact that we have a major category, de'oraita, from the Torah of not putting out a fire on the Sabbath as one of the 39 av malachot, as one of the 39 major categories of work that we do not do on Shabbat. Yet, there will now be some distinctions created in order to potentially put out the fire. So the question, how could they do that and allow somebody to put out the fire if they're going like this and they're saying put out the fire? That, okay, you could ask that question, but you still, there's no good answer to that question.
So yes, every question is a good question. But if that's the nature of the question already, the simple answer is because the rabbi said so. And the rabbis want you to have some space in order to act. And again, just to point it out before we get into the guts of the Mishnah, they want you to have learned this, they want you to have digested this, they want you to have read this, they want you to have listened to the drashot, and they want you to have done that so often that now, in terms of your everyday practice, you don't have to stop and say, wait a minute, let me check that. They want it to be as natural as, I've compared it to the professional athlete who's read the rules of the game, to the referee who needs to blow the whistle at this moment. If I'm a referee and I don't really backwards front know the rules and I haven't had the game experience, I don't make it to the big leagues. Shabbos is the big leagues. And that's why they're expecting that, no, you're not going to stop and this is not going to be a total crutch, this kind of text. By the way, you don't have this text. You only heard it orally. So with that as the introduction into this particular Mishnah, what you need to know is that the beginning of the parak was all about the fire that broke out and what you could save and what you couldn't save. And here we go with certain things that are going to be on fire. And Rabbi Shimon's going to teach us a lesson. I gave you a handout. And though we're on 120A5 in the Schottenstein edition of the Gemara, I gave you the handout because we are looking at the Yad Avraham, which is a commentary on the Mishnah. So everybody's got this page in front of them that I passed out, and the Mishnah is on one side of the page where it says Rabbi Shimon, where it says OZ Talmud class on the copy. So look at the photocopy I handed around. Here you go. If we need more, I have a couple more over here.
Anybody need one?
All right, so Mishnah. I'm in Mishnah Hay, where it said Matnitin in the page of Talmud, because the bigger Mem Tav Nun Yud is the introduction of a Mishnah on the page of Talmud, towards the bottom of Kuf Kaf Aleph. Rabbi Shimon ben Nana Somer, Rabbi Shimon ben Nana says the following: Porsin Or Shel Gedi Al Gabe Shida Teva Migdal She'achaz Behen Et Ha'ur Mivnei Shehu Mecharech. Rabbi Shimon ben Nana teaches the following: we may spread a kid's hide over a chest, a box, or a closet that has caught fire. Okay, so what's the problem immediately if I'm just reading the Mishnah? The problem is the problem I told you about. We studied the laws of the Mishnah. We knew that from the major categories, putting out a fire was asur, it was forbidden. And yet, here he goes and he says, because we all know what happens when you put a goat skin atop something that's burning. You know, he's got a chest, a box, or a closet. And what do? You go get the goat skin. And what do here? You smother it. It's called smothering. It's a legitimate way to put out a fire. So he's going to hold that you can do that. Why? These things did catch on fire. The word or here is an interesting word, by the way, because it's not or, it's or with a shuruk, and it's ur. And when you say to somebody Happy Hanukkah in what we call Ivrit Shel Shabbat, in high order Hebrew, you say Chag Ha'orim Sameach. Not Orim, Urim. Chag Ha'orim Sameach. A festival of fires. A happy festival of fires, of kindling. Not, well, like they glowed. So Urim. So if these things caught on fire, you can throw that on top because it singes. Because a hide singes and does not burn. Thus it protects the wooden boxes from burning. The Mishnah is not giving the reason one is permitted to spread a kid's hide over burning boxes, but the reason one should want to do it. Why? Why should one want to do it? because you're not going to catch the skin on fire. Rather, you're only going to singe the actual goat skin. So somebody paint the picture here for themselves if you need the visual. And somebody else just kind of think about the way he's getting around the law. It's not kibui ha'esh. It's not putting out the fire. It's covering over the item that's on fire. Because what? The fire only singes the skin. I'm not adding any fuel. Period. It's not a firefighting method.
If it's choking the fire.
It's not a firefighting method according to the rabbis.
But it's choking the fire because there's no oxygen.
But the skin singes, so the fire has to stop.
Exactly. The skin actually singes. So in the diuk, in the distinction, it's that the skin singes, but there's obviously not enough fuel for the fire to keep going.
Does the fire also go out?
That's the implication. The fire is used up, perhaps, would be a different way of saying it. Maybe. They know from such, they're not defining it here. But what I'm pointing out is that they're not doing kibui. It's important that we understand the distinctions when it comes to the way the rabbis might be thinking.
They don't want to call it kibui, but they...
But they're not calling it kibui.
It's just not... The oxygen becomes depleted. My candles go out because there's no wax left. And here the flame goes up because the oxygen's depleted.
I put something to take the oxygen out.
I think, maybe this is totally wrong, but I think it's in contradistinction to water. So if you put water on, the water wouldn't flame or sing. It would just put out the fire. So here, the fact that it's singeing means that the fire has not been put out.
But now it's complicated, Barry, because I was glad someone says that in contradistinction to water. Is it really in contradistinction to water? Let's read what Rashi says. Down below on the Daf Gemara, where it says the Matnitin in the larger letters, go down to the capital, the big bold Matnitin. What's Rashi's first entry on the Mishnah? So if you put your finger on the bottom wide lines of Rashi, right? So if you're in the Gemara and you put your finger directly into the middle of the Gemara page, what do you get? In this case, you get Gemara. If you want to do it with me, you'll figure out what's on the page. So you go right down to the middle of the Gemara, you're in the Gemara. If you go down past where you have Gemara text, into the little bit of white gap, down below, you have wide lines of Rashi. In this case, Rashi was narrow for a lot of your page and then widened out. Okay? Sometimes they'll wrap Rashi all the way around a page. Tosafot is very little on this page. There's one entry. It's Edie. Down below, Matnitin, or Shel Gedi. What does he say? Loch! What does it mean? It's dampened. There's water on it. So wait a minute. Is this putting water on the fire through a skin that's been doused? Interesting how the conversation goes, because that's Rashi's take on what is going on here. And if you look at the note, 42, the Gemara initially assumes this to be the reason that Rabbi Shimon ben Anas permits this, because the hide doesn't extinguish the fire, it merely prevents the fire from spreading because itself does not burn. The Gemara, however, will conclude otherwise. The Mishnah speaks of a raw hide that is still moist. So it's not that it was water and somebody put water on it. What was it? According to Rashi, this moistness, as we might have read on the simplest sense, that it was water and that was doused. Oh, no, that's not what he meant. What he meant was it was lach, as in it was still moist because it hadn't entirely been tanned. It was a pretty fresh goat skin that you had around. And this, however, presents a problem for the Gemara above. It said that a raw hide may only be carried when there is still meat attached to it. Oh, because remember, we had a whole discussion in the Gemara above. And a fresh raw hide, how many of those are you really going to have around? Otherwise, it's considered mukta. So now I have a problem that I'm actually being told to use something that I can't actually pick up. Because remember, mukta is the category of belongings and the category of items that I have a fence around from rabbinic injunction that I can't touch on a Shabbat. How then does our Mishnah permit carrying such a hide to cover a burning carriage trunk or a closet? Tosafos answered that our Mishnah is speaking of a case where the hide had been designated for use in its raw condition, thereby removing it from the category of muksa. The Mishnah Brewer adds that according to those who hold that even muksa may be moved when it's threatened by fire, our Mishnah can be discussing any kind of hide. So you see that there are ways here. There are ways to understand it. Now I want to say an interesting piece. Studying this Mishnah this week sent me to go looking in my favorite, part of my favorite notions of Gemara, the material culture of ancient Israel and Sasanian Babylonia. So Daniel Sperber and one other scholar at the Hebrew U named Biber actually do work in the areas of material culture. We've looked at different kinds of amphora, and we've looked at different kinds of racks for them, and some were kept straight up and some were kept sideways, and then I told you about mezuzot and how we found different doorposts with holes in them versus otherwise. So I searched this week for an article about furniture production in the days of the Talmud in the ancient world. Because here we have a Mishnah that obviously knows three things that were produced. A chest, a box, and a closet. So the closets were actually pretty close to what we have right here. This is what they meant by a closet. A two-door kind of aron, which today in Israel you can get if you buy an apartment, nothing's built into the walls. And
An armoire,
right? And it wasn't as...
But that was for arms. An armoire comes because they had arms in them.
Right, so I didn't call them an armoire. They actually used the name that the Torah was used, aron. So it's interesting that could take on a holy attribute when it was actually in the Beit Knesset in the synagogue and used for the Torah, and in one's home you still had an aron, and of course the aron becomes a name that you have in using for a coffin. But here the opposite, well, not the opposite, but a different word for aron is used, and that is a what? A migdal. A migdal. A closet is called somewhat of a tower. Right? And so a migdal is not a tower in this case. A migdal is what we would call either an aron or an armoire in today's parlance. So what was interesting about this, and there's only been, at least to my knowledge, one can only find one article about Rehit B'Yemea Talmud, furniture and furnishings in the days of the Talmud in that part of the world. I think more research is being done in material culture today than ever, as I've told you before. And it was kind of started by Daniel Sperber writing these two volumes about material culture in this time. But part of it is that the Mishnah lets us know, as the document of that age, what was around. Some say that these kind of chests and boxes are all made of wood. Some say that we can't read it as being only made of wood, but that certain stonemasonry was good at creating the kind of boxes and the box tops that were necessary for the time. And that one could have in one's house either things of wood or things of stone. Of course, if a fire broke out in it, you're not talking about stone that won't catch. You're talking about wood. So obviously the three things in this case are made of some type of wood or some at least type of flammable substance. We know from the ancient world and from years beyond, millennia beyond, baskets and basket weaving has, you know, its own kind of character in different parts of the ancient world. You can read deeper histories about those types of technologies. And you, of course, have earthenware vessels, which are going to come into the Mishnah in just a moment as the second part of this Mishnah. So we really are here isolating, potentially, to understand what these type of wooden furniture pieces were really all about, how they were made, where they were made, were they imported, were they done... you know, kind of at home, what were the trades like? The fur trade is the only industry that's made into any kind of research article in the Encyclopedia Judaica. furniture and furniture trade is not within the confines of the Encyclopedia Judaica or the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is found on it. Again, interesting to note that the fur trade was. A little bit more about the fur trade in ancient world and through the European into new American lands, as it was a really essential part of business. But furniture wasn't there.
This carriage, this over a carriage trunk or closet.
Right, right. So you could say, you could.
So what is a carriage? How is a carriage defined? That's a carriage.
Well, you could say that the carriage in this translation, right, which in that translation does say carriage, and in this one says, in Steinsaltz, a box, a chest, or a closet. So it was kind of the box that went onto, let's say you were riding with an ox or a horse, and you had a seat and you had a little bit of an enclosure that could come off and on with some straps. So that's the kind of box they're talking about. By the way, the same scholar who wrote about boxes and furniture wrote about the riding of horses and the trade of horses in the ancient world. And just an interesting aside. Meanwhile, no one's put out the book yet about furniture in the days of the Mishnah, if you're looking to write something interesting.
Is there any prohibition if a box is empty to throw things in here and then put the skin over it? Because then it falls into the category of what you can save.
Well, last week we learned a Mishnah about how you could gather things into some type of, you know, what do you call those sticks?
Bindle.
A bindle, right. So that you could wrap it all up and tie your bandana. And so you
are able to...
Actually, the box isn't what's suggested. It's either a basket, which is a bigger basket that can contain smaller ones, or some type of cloth or skin that you then, you know, kind of bundle up and you make it into a bundle. All right, so let's push forward in the Mishnah. V'osin mechitza v'chol ha-kelim. And you may make a partition with any vessels, bein mala'im, bein reikanim, whether they are full or whether they are empty. Bishvil shalot ha'avur hadaleka, so that the fire will not spread. Now what's the idea here? You have the aron, it's against the wall. That's what's on fire. I have a whole lot of jugs around, whether they're full or they're empty. What could they be full of at this time? A jug.
Water.
Wine.
Oil.
Grains. Maybe money if I'm using one of them to hide my money. Dried fruits.
or maybe books.
Scrolls. So the Mishnah is interested, of course, with liquids right now, because they're going to get into a discussion about whether or not any kind of bursting of an earthenware vessel, in this case, will allow for a liquid to pour out and put out the fire. So it says whether they're full or they're empty, so that it won't spread. Now, even if the heat will burst the vessels, the Yad Avraham says, thereby releasing the water and quenching the fire, this is still permissible. It fits into the category of Garam Kibui. Garam Kibui. Indirectly causing a fire to be extinguished, rather than extinguishing it by direct effort. The causation, rather than direct performance, of a malacha, malacha being one of the works that we do not allow on Shabbat, because it's in the 39 categories of major work that we say are forbidden, that's generally rabbinically prohibited. However, in a case of financial loss, the rabbis did not prohibit it.
It says right here, it is forbidden.
It's going to say that, right? It says like this. You can make a machitza with all of your vessels, whether they're full or whether they're empty, so that the fire won't spread. Let's full stop. So can I put my vessels down? if they're filled with water at this point?
Yes.
Yes, I can. But I'm going to have a secondary opinion. So when I have this in a Mishnah, I have a structure of the Tana Kama, if I just want to separate this part of the Mishnah out, the Tana Kama, the first Tana who teaches about these vessels, actually permits. That's an anonymous Tana, meaning it's the sages in the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi comes, though, and what does he do? He forbids it. Rabbi Yossi Oser, Bichle Cheres Hadashim Leim Mayim, Rabbi Yossi prohibits making a partition with new earthenware vessels filled with water, Lefisha Ein Yecholin Lekabel Et Ha'ur, because they cannot endure the fire. The hen mitbakin, and they crack, umechabin et hadleka, and extinguish the fire. So if I'm Rabbi Yossi, and I hold by Rabbi Yossi, I'm one of his students, and I have a fire in my house, and I have the aron on the wall, and I have relatively new earthenware vessels, and they're filled with water, am I allowed to make the partition? No. I have to go with my rabbi's thought.
And if the vessel is old?
If the vessel's old, we didn't have the Mishnah say anything about it.
Well, so it's good to keep old stuff.
Maybe. Because he did say, if you want
to
be...
We don't say anything, we don't apply the new to the old. We just assume that it's a completely different situation.
Right. So I can, in the way that I function within the law, hang my hat on one word. If we were just reading the Mishnah, good point. I want to keep those old ones around.
What define you?
Did it say? This is the challenge of reading a Mishnah. This is what it's about. This is if I was to say to you in Havruta, learn this Mishnah and come up with all the possible questions about the actual what the Mishnah says before we get to any Gemara, these would be excellent questions. Because it said nothing, I'm not able to answer the question according to this Mishnah. And what I'm interested in right now, of course, is this Mishnah. Now, there could be major conversations about some of the very questions that we're asking right now in the Rishonim. Some of them yes, some of them no. But for right now, the Mishnah is giving us this way of understanding, Rabbi Yossi. I might also check manuscripts, which would be an interesting move, which I didn't get to do yet. Do they all say Hadashim? Do they all say new? Maybe there are some manuscripts that are going to leave out the word new. Maybe new earthenware means distinguished from the other earthenware vessels that I have made from a different type of clay. Maybe it doesn't even mean Hadash as we're thinking of. You go to the store, you get a couple of new dishes.
But just in principle, is it realistic to think that when a fire breaks out, people are afraid of getting burned and there's fire around them, that they are going to remember these very specific things in order to act exactly like this? It seems as though you're in a kind of emergency situation with a fire brewing. So do we really think that people said, I can't do this cloth because it's, you know, because the hide is a little moist, and I can't do this because it's older than that? And
this is precisely what I was referencing at the outset, that it's very easy to think that it would be stultifying, that I would be stopped in my tracks every time if I had to make a religious choice about what goes on right now, right? I'll give you the for instance, though. I hope I know well enough the chart of what happens in the Beit Knesset when we come across a Torah that is missing a letter, so that I don't have to sit there and learn for 15 minutes before I actually tell you what's doing. I hope I know that well enough. Please, God. I happen to know, thank God, the one that happened when we had one of those instances in the Beit Knesset. I happen to, at that moment, remember, we were past three verses of the last Aliyah. We could finish the Aliyah. I could then wrap the Torah belt around it. We could say, as is the custom that I learned from my teacher, which is not even in the book, Lamadnu mimena, we learned from her, v'nachzor elech, and we're going to return to you. Because the idea is to get it fixed in time, to put it back in the Aron HaKodesh, before the cycle of reading is done in that scroll that we had started with for the year. So I am hopeful, if I'm the rabbis of the Talmudic era, that I know my rabbi's shita. I know the sages, at least, approach. If it's really in developmental stages, as I've indicated that some of this law really was, I might go according to one sage and be at the mercy of, you know, later on, like we're going to hear, you know, Rava, I think it was, or Rava, he kind of frowns on people who do it this way. Even though the Braita, even though the Tanaitic teaching and the Mishnah or a different Braita said it that way. You know, he'll kind of curse and say, you know, you're really doing the wrong thing if you're going with that teaching. Even though it's the, you know, Braita that says it. Even though in our system we've said that you should go by a Braita that says that. So there is that hope. There's that dynamic conversation going on between Jews and their teachers at this stage in our history and then into the future. You know, that's why people make a point of learning halakha throughout their weeks as well as part of their plan of learning.
I understand, but I do think that fire breaks out with everybody, the people who aren't such good learners and the people who aren't so slipped and all of that.
What about the women? They don't study Torah, right?
It's
an equal opportunity.
The informed nature of Jewish living is this. There's law about it. There's also, as you're suggesting, the maaseh. Look at and go see what happens. Right? So there's no doubt that you pursue life. There's no doubt about it. Pikuach nefesh is first. Saving a life, there's no doubt about these things. But again, part of the culture is to be really reflective on even those moments. And I've told you the story, I think, that night I said it, you know, about some of the emergencies that I've gone to the hospital with families who are Shabbat, really, you know, truly Shabbat observant families. And they're making all kinds of distinctions based on what kind of they know in their fiber is the way to preserve the modicum of Shabbat, even in the moment of their greatest stress and their children literally bleeding. You know, and we would look at it on the one hand and say, how now? And on the other hand, it really allows them to function with a certain type of allegiance and kedusha and holiness that has been defined. As they reflect.
I was going to say, partially in response to Avi's question, which I wondered, if you have a fire emergency, are you going to follow the rules? In my experience, for a long time practicing medicine, it was during emergencies that people most followed the rules. And if women or children didn't know, they were the most scared and would do what they were told. So in fact, the times when people deliberated were when there were non-emergencies. There was like a real, you know, situation. You remembered what you're supposed to do. You did what you were told, and that's when the rules.
If you did, if you were practicing that through the years.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was like 20 years.
Time and whatever.
No, but the point is that you remember. Let's say you're one of these guys studying Talmud. You remember. All right, there's a fire. This is what I do, and you just. It comes to you. It's part of like and that's when you don't question things. That's when you do. Or in my limited experience, but I think in general, human nature during emergencies tend to do what they're told by authorities or learned.
But you need to be trained. It's like being a soldier. Soldiers do that exactly by the rule. Whatever they do, it's always by the rule.
And maybe even more.
And as more dangerous is the situation, the more the rule
occupies
the meshes with the terrain. I'm all for safety.
But they are trained. They are all trained for it. But in this case, at home, there are kids, there are wives, nobody's trained.
So I used to, when I would train medical students or interns or residents, my point was that there are some things I want them not to be needing to think about. That had to be subcortical, meaning it had to be a reflex. And it had to be built into them so that there was no question. You were going to do this, and if you saw this, you were going to do that, and if that, you were going to do that. And so that there at least in that emergency situation, there's absolutely no deviation from that game plan. And obviously, they must have had a very similar notion.
I think that's well put on both fronts.
This maybe we'll get into it, but this seems to be at odds with the idea of it's okay to do something indirect, because this is...
Right, so that is where the Gemara is going to really go and going to explore it philosophically, and what is indirect and what is direct, and I want to get to the language of the Gemara to see that through, but hold that as the underpinning of the discussion.
I'm not certain that in this case how to deal with saving property or taking what's essential in case of a fire on Shabbat could be compared to behavior in combat or in an emergency situation, medical situation, because a lot of what the rabbis express suggests that they, to me, that they maybe think, you know what, you got to do whatever you think is best. Because what bothered me very much in the case of the rescuing of the Torah, they discussed the case where the Torah's been erased.
Right.
Then there's the question of how many letters are remaining.
Right.
This is not something that anybody could react instinctively to words. You're in shul, the fire breaks out, everybody's screaming, panicking, the ladies develop any fainting, and they're thinking, now, I suggest that in the expanded version of these rules is we don't actually have a hard and fast. You can't do this, but actually, you got to do what you got to do.
Well, that's why there is that level always in here of, you know, lama'ase. I don't have the book. I don't crack it open at the moment. I don't get stopped in my tracks. I do save. I am informed some of this is, I like that, subcortical. They definitely had that sense that we could train people to live this life in this kind of rhythmic, you know, lizard response or however you want to call it. But that it's so integrated, at the moment that you need it, you're going to draw from it. I recall one story of my friend Danny, who took a birthing class, and he read lots and lots and lots, and the birth had never happened. It was a child coming, and of course he read several times what happens when the cord is wrapped around the child's neck, and how you kind of have to go like this and do this. Turns out that Bella goes into labor, and he gets into the minivan that they have, and he's driving down from the St. Gabriel foothills in Los Angeles, and God knows the traffic on the 405 is the traffic on the 405, and he pulls off into a gas station, and Bella gives birth, and the cord's wrapped around the baby's neck, and instinctually, having read this any number of times, preparing himself as the nervous father, he unwraps the cord, the baby would have died. EMS gets there, shuffles the baby off because they think that the family is involved in some type of doing drugs, because who has a baby that fast and in a van that looks like it's from 1972?
Jules?
And long story short, if it were not for his preparation in reading and taking a birth so seriously, and I would say that people who are really reading this to take Shabbat so seriously and listening to the rabbi's drashot, that's the kind of culture that I want you to see unfolded according to the rabbis. Now, does that mean it's as punctilious as some of what goes on in someone's household as the salt shaker sits there and there's a little bit still on the table and the cap is off and someone says, let me go get volume number 2 of Shabbat Ki Hilchata, Sabbath according to the law, and today, because I've been at those tables too, I don't really know that they wanted that as the culture. I don't. On the other hand, I've explained it like this, that when you're young and you want to play a game with your friends and you take the box top off and you all agree that you're going to play the game because the rules on the back of the box really allow you to have this kind of fun move around the board and give each other the Monopoly money and buy the hotels and collect the rents, you know, that's basically the game of Shabbat for a lot of these families who are believing as well that there's a dimension of spiritual kind of potential redemption that comes from all this. So I think we have to be somewhat anthropological, you know, sociological, anthropological investigators of that as we sit here, if it's not something we've experienced ourselves, to say, you know, this is part of our peoplehood.
And the last thing I'm just going to say is that the other possibility is that it's an opportunity, as we've seen a lot, to talk about indirect causes and to introduce that principle. And maybe people were taking it very literally, but they were using this as an opportunity to talk about a subject that has kind of a bigger...
No doubt about it. And where Musar literature went... ethical literature, only a few centuries ago, using principles that come out of our Gemara, are to talk about those kinds of interactions between people based on the legal principles coming out of Gemara. And when we get there again, I'm going to show you how that's applied. So, two of you have identified where the Gemara is going and where later Jewish history has gone. Let's read the Gemara. So I'm now on 120A5. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav. Talit she'achaz ba'ha'ur mitzad echad, a cloak in which fire has taken hold on one side. Not nina le'hamayim mitzad acher. We may place water on it from the other side. Oh, now we're really directly, though, talking about water. As if they didn't think that someone put a little water on goat hair. Rashi said it was a fresh goat hide. I can't imagine the Gemara starting like this if they didn't think that it was talking about having a goat hide around and having some kind of water trickling down one of the sides of the hide. Just from the fact that this is where the Gemara starts. Ve'im kavta kavta. And if the fire is thereby extinguished, it's extinguished and one hasn't violated any prohibition. Now, just because these notes are really fun when it comes to this. 44. Note 44. Although if the smolder continues to spread across the cloak, it will reach the water-soaked part of the garment and be extinguished. The person has not directly extinguished the fire since he didn't pour the water on the part that was already burning. Rather, he merely causes the fire to burn itself out when it reaches the wet part. So you have to be careful as to how much of the actual hide you've put water on. According to Rav, causing a fire to be extinguished is permitted. Garam kibui. In other words, indirect action creating the action of the fire being extinguished.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
Seemingly, it should be forbidden to wet the other side of the garment because of the rule taught by the Gemara in Zvachim. Beged shiriato zehu kibuso. In the case of a cloth, its wetting is its laundering. Now, if I have the problem with putting out the fire, or I don't, you still have another problem. What's the halachic problem I have?
Laundering.
Okay. That's forbidden on the Sabbath, too. Because of the question, Rashbam, cited by the Tosafot, explains that Rav does not mean that the water is actually poured onto the cloak. Tosafot are also of the opinion that the rule that wetting a cloth is equivalent to laundering it applies only to a cloth that is spotted or stained, as Tosafot explained at length on 111AB. So wait a minute. The fire situation. I've got a cloth over here, or the hide. I'm going to pour a little water on it. Or it's the talit, or it's the cloak, or it's the hide. I have to go over and I have to put out this fire quickly. And if I have a little water over here, I can splash it on, and I could be fine if I'm going according to Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav, that I put it down, and the fire reaches the water, and I haven't done any malach, I haven't done any chet, I haven't done any transgression on transgressing kibui, on putting out a fire. But I might have transgressed if it was being laundered, but only if the actual cloak or hide had stains and I put water on, would I be doing any laundering. Otherwise, if it had none of that, I wouldn't have to worry about the laundering part. Simple as that. So I have to check out whether or not the hide has any stains. So, you know, you see how the jumping jacks are going. It's for the training of the mind. It's for the training of the mind and the ability to respond in a moment that keeps as much of the culture going as is possible. If I may, I'd like to get through some of the Gemara before we start a next round of discussion, because it's good to see where the Gemara is going and how the thinking plays out. Rav Yehuda's ruling is questioned. Meitaveh is a technical term in the Gemara. Meitaveh comes along and says, I have a braita that actually challenges the position. Talicha chazbaha urmitzadeh, had a cloak in which a fire is taken hold on the one side. Poshta umit kaseba, one may unfold it and cover himself with it. V'im kavta, and if the fire is thereby extinguished, it's extinguished. So in other words, it has a little fire on it. I grab it quickly, has obviously got to be the case. I put it around, and I, in essence, smothered it. Okay? It's a pretty dangerous move, but on the other hand, it's right. Or, if it has a little fire...
Superheroes become...
That's right. And if it's otherwise, that I know how to fold it on my shoulders, which you've seen, people who wear talitot that are larger, they have to do this folding. So if I have that kind of cloak that I have to put on a shoulder, and I smother it, that's another possibility. V'chein sefer Torah she'achaz bo ha'or, and likewise a Torah scroll in which a fire is taken hold, poshto v'korebo, I can actually unroll it and read it. So what am I doing if it's caught fire over here a little bit, and I open it up by kind of rolling this way, I kind of make enough of a covering of one part. I cover up one part of the parchment that's on fire by rolling it into itself, and I've now extinguished it, right? So I can open it up and read it, and if the fire is thereby extinguished, it's extinguished. Vim kava kava. Now the braita permits dealing with the fire only in this more indirect manner, but not by placing water on the other side of the cloak. How then could Rav Yehuda permit this putting water on it? Not nilei hamayim mitzad acher. How could he say? Because if I'm going by the braita and I'm Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav, teaching how people how to do this, and I only have a braita that supports me like this, that I can roll it to a place, or I could fold it, but I have no water put on it, how could I have a teaching? Well, turn the page. Now we're on 120 side B. Gemara answers this problem. Who de Amar to Rabbi Shimon ben Nanas? Ah, he must have been teaching like Rabbi Shimon ben Nanas of our Mishnah. What did Shimon ben Nanas of our Mishnah say? That what?
You can put the skin under it with a goat.
Right, you can smother it with the goat's hide. As it says in our Mishnah, Rabbi Shimon ben Nanas Omer, Porcine, Or Shel Gedi Al Gaves, Shida Teva, Migdal Shachaz Ben Etaor, Mivneshahum Micharech. So if I can put that over it and keep it from spreading, I'm fine to do these other things. So I now have an understanding of Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav. He wasn't teaching according to that braita. I wasn't using a braita as my source. The braita, in this case, being the Mishnaic teaching, right, by a Tana, he's actually teaching by the Tana of our Mishnah, Rav Shimon ben Nanas. Part of the Gemara's project is to try to understand, in whose system am I teaching my law? In whose system am I actually teaching? That will be part of why the Gemara goes back and forth and toggles between that braita, which had a shita, had a system, and the shita of the Mishnah, the system of the Mishnah. The Gemara protests, though, that the cases are not analogous. Classic move again. Amar! But, one could say, De'amar Rabbi Shimon ben Nanas, that Rabbi Shimon ben Nanas says, Mipnei shehu mecharech, because it singes and prevents the fire from spreading further. Gram kibui mi'amar. Did he ever say that it's permitted to actually cause the extinguishment of the fire, as Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Rav? So wait a minute, he's saying, oh, you said you could put a little mayim on it. We all know mayim actually puts out the fire. And he's not saying that you can gram kibui, that you can have this indirect action of putting out the fire. Over there, we're making a distinction between what is singe and what is cause the fire to go out. So I'm understanding Rabbi Shimon ben Anas to be saying that the fire only singes over here, and then therefore the fire doesn't spread, it simply singes, and what happens to it? It's not being put out by way of the verb lechabot, to be put out. Simply doing as much as it can, and it is no more. That's basically the way I have to understand the Gemara, by making it in contradistinction to the teaching of, right, to the teaching of Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav, who says with a little bit of water on it, I can actually put it on to the item that's on fire. The Gemara answers, Ein midekatani sefer. Yep, Rabbi Shimon ben Anoch does indeed permit causing extinguishment, guys. It's okay for him. Gram kibui. For the end of the Mishnah teaches, Rabbi Yossi oser bichli cheres chadashim alei mayim. Rabbi Yossi prohibits making a partition with new earthenware vessels filled with water. And if the end of the Mishnah, she'ein an yacholin lekabel et ha'ur v'hen mit... and if they can't withstand the fire and they burst open and the water comes, we infer that what? The true Tanakhama of the Mishnah, who's Rabbi Shimon ben Anas, must disagree with Rabbi Yossi, who teaches at the end of the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi at the end of the Mishnah says what? Can't use water. But he says it only in the sense that you can't put those earthenware vessels there because they're going to break and crack and then pour on. But here, you can see that the Tanakhama, Rabbi Shimon ben Anas, who disputes Rabbi Yossi, permits even the use of new earthenware vessels filled with water. And if he permits the use of new earthenware vessels filled with water, what would he say about Rabbi Yehuda in the name of Rav, who said that I could put a little water? It's okay with me. This is a resolution. Good. Know who you're going to follow, Ron.
So, I'm not allowed to distinguish a fire on Shabbat, but I'm allowed to have the intent to distinguish fire on Shabbat as long as I'm using a middle agent to do the job for me.
In this case, it seems like that's where they're going.
So, why can I do it on any other function of 39 melachot?
I might be able to if I can apply the principle across
like,
the board.
Like somebody drive for me.
Like somebody drive. So if I look at the tshuvot of the conservative...
I'm allowed to have the intent, but I'm not allowed. I need a middle agent to do it.
Or, frankly, there are other ways to even argue, as they did in those tshuvot of the conservative movement, which were that I have lots of principles I can apply to what I do when I drive. If you're telling me that lighting a fire in my car is a malacha because it's creating esh, let's say. But I have a principle. Wait. But I have a principle that says if I create that fire, and I don't need that fire for the malacha of the Mishkan, for the work that I did in the actual portable tabernacle, it's a malacha she'enot tzricha legufa. It's a category of work that I'm doing, that I'm lighting this fire, but I don't need it for the same reason they needed it back in the day of building the tabernacle. Therefore, what? Shari. Permissible. This is the kind of application, again, that we've talked about in different questions, right? If I have this principle, how could they say that principle? And if I have this application over here, how can we say that the application can't be applied over there? We actually do it on Yontif. We actually apply the principle of carrying for tzorech, for needs to carry things on Yontif. We say, since we already apply the principle of carrying on Yontif for things that we need, we also say for things we don't need, we're going to say it's permissible to carry.
But my question is, why I'm allowed to have the intent even, because I'm not allowed to distinguish fire. Intent is already the best thing.
Right, so they're going to get to the question of intent, and we're going to explore it further. And I just want to make the point here that even though I can apply lots of things and make distinctions, the rabbis can also at a given moment decide and show how it doesn't really work, how the application is different. Shani Hatam. It's different over there. And we have to, in understanding the legal system of the rabbis, accept sometimes that they will apply something or they won't apply a principle in a way that we see as possible. And that's the job sometimes of the Rishonim. The Rishonim will come along and say about the Gemara, wait a minute, halacha l'maaseh, Jewish law, actual Jewish law, applicable law, maybe I could really produce the answer that I can do something when I was told I couldn't in the Gemara because of the application of this principle in one way or another. Or at least I understand that this rabbi who felt at that moment that it was permissible, like Rabbi Shimon ben Anas here. What does Shimon ben Anas really do? He doesn't agree with Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi said he should put water on it. You couldn't put water on it, and these new earthenware vessels would break and it would douse the fire. But to do it, Rabbi Shimon ben Anas said yes, so Rabbi Yehuda in the name of Rav says, yeah, you can, and therefore, even though the halacha came down that generally I can't put water on a fire, I can go with the system where it's an indirect thing, and even with my intentionality. If so far, we would go with what we know from the Gemara. Okay, so let's go into the brayta, the next brayta of the Gemara. I'm on the left side of 120b1. The Gemara cites a brayta now. Again, brayta, Tanaitic teaching, important in the sense that it sometimes trumps later teachings of the Amoraim. Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis teach in the brayta. Ner sh'al gabei tavla. If a lit lamp is on top of a board that one wishes to move, mina eret ha-tavla v'hino felet, one may shake the board and let the lamp fall down. V'im kavta kavta, and if the lamp is thereby extinguished, it's extinguished. What type of lamps do I have as a possibility? I have a candle. Least likely. Oil lamp. Or look at the notes. Let's see.
Electricity.
I don't think they... So you'll see that the distinction here is between an oil lamp or a candle. Since the lamp is muktzeh and may not be carried, someone who wishes to carry the board must first endeavor to remove the lamp from it. He cannot simply remove it by hand since it's muktzeh. Therefore, he must remove it indirectly by shaking the board and allowing it to fall off. Although this may result in extinguishing the fire of the lamp, since it is not his intention to extinguish, nor is it inevitable, which we'll get to that principle in a minute, it's called Psik Resha, that he will do so, it is permitted. Tosfot asks how one is allowed to shake off the lamp when some of its oil is sure to be spilled as a result, and removing oil from a burning lamp is in itself a malacha of extinguishing. I can't remove oil from a lamp. Tosafos therefore explained.
I don't know how all these fires start.
Tosafos therefore explained that the brisa is speaking of a lamp that has no more oil in it. Alternatively, we're dealing with a wax candle. So where I was going with the other, it was unfair, like three times. It wasn't three times. Really two types. Wax candle or oil candle. I could have said four types. That's either still lit or not. That's either still lit or not. That's just to put all the possibilities out there, right? So, I now have the principle of Muksa. I think I've showed you this book before, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a book that actually you do have to bring to the Beit Midrash with you, regardless of your age, stage, or place of learning. If you're learning about the 39 categories of work on the Sabbath, and you're going through Gemaras, and you really want to see from the Jewish world of Haredi Jerusalem, how they actually teach this stuff, so that you're not reading inside the Gemara when you're a little kid, but you're sitting with your Tati or your Abba, and you're actually reading about this world, and you want to exactly know. So this is the page about Muksa. Okay? And this page about Muksa, about things that are prohibited to you, goes through all categories. And you read it Shabbat after Shabbat with your little ones, and I saw, you know, I lived with the Haredi family in their house, Jason, 2 years, each of those little kids, practically, every Shabbat, this is what you do. You go through.
2 years?
What?
You lived in it for 2 years?
Yeah. And this is what you do. And you go through, and you read it, and you study it, and you learn it. This is the page. These are the pages about sheep shearing, and that you don't do that, and here are the outcomes of that in today's modern world, and this is about Mal Ben, and you see the guy, he's doing the laundry down here. So you don't scrub clothes, you don't twist clothes, you don't soak clothing, you don't, you learn that leather surfaces may be washed with water without scraping, you know. So all these little pieces are here. And the Muksa page, there are 6 main categories of Muksa. So you learn to categorize things over time. And what you have is, and by the way, this is really a serious book, and how do you know that books are serious in the Jewish world? You see that, hold on. Right. Actually, I think I took it out. It came with a letter in it that was inside, and there were several letters of, you know, this rabbi and that rabbi and this rabbi endorsed this book and says these are very serious, and according to all general, you know, post-scheme of our generation, this halachic decisor is the way to understand things. So the first category of muksa is mechamat chisron kis. Delicate objects used only for their intended purpose because of their costliness. Such as stationery, fountain pen, violin, electric microscope, a shechita knife, or a camera. Basis, though, an object which supports a mukta item acquires the same mukta status as the object it is supporting. So, if I have a tray that my wallet's on, and the tray I could use on Shabbat because it's simply a tray, it now is muktzah, though I can't touch it if my wallet is on it. Because my wallet, even though the wallet is not the money, is muktzah. Because I don't touch my wallet based on the fact that the money in it is something that I wouldn't take out because my job is to keep my business away from the shuk on a Sabbath. This is the kind of systemic piece that the rabbis are creating. I remind you, people are hearing this. And they're saying, is this a good thing for me? Is this good for our community? Is this good for our world? Now, mind you, muktzah might have been created before Chazal, before the sages. But it definitely, in our estimation, our best estimation, wasn't categorized into six categories. That was part of the project of Talmudic literature. Mechamat gufo, objects that are not utensils and have no ordinary Sabbath function. So frozen raw fish, untied fruit, raw potato, money, raw spaghetti, plant, earth, all these things that I can do nothing with become muktzah. Mechamat isur, objects whose use was prohibited because of Sabbath violations when Sabbath began. So I don't touch those. Klisha melachto leisur, utensils designed specifically for doing work, so such as tefillin, which I would never use on Shabbat. I don't need to wrap them because they're not signs that I need to present before God. They are muktzah. So at the beginning of the Sabbath downstairs, I take my tefillin out of my talis bag, which I usually keep there for during the week, and I put them aside because I don't want to carry that bag that has tefillin in it. There's also different kinds of tools that someone may use to build. So all those tools become things that I wouldn't use. Except, by the way, there's some kind of understanding that if I want to take a hammer, and generally, you know, I use the hammer to put in a nail, right? But I want to take the part, the claw, right? It's not the teeth. So I want to take the claw, and I want to open a bottle of, well, beer, let's say, because I got to use the claw somehow. So I might be able to use it for that, because that's lo lemelachto. That's not for its work. That's not. It's for a different purpose.
You can't use the hammer thing. You can use it on Shabbat or in the morning because you're making a dedication. And then you can't use anything that's on your hammer.
Unless you're using it for a different purpose that it wouldn't be normally used for. So that level of tool, I could. Just as a for instance of where the laws go and how they're explained.
Can you use a bottle opener?
I can use a bottle opener
not
if I'm...
for a bottle. Bring me a bottle opener. I'm opening a bottle, bring me a hammer.
Can you imagine where the Talmud...
a manicure.
Can you imagine where the Talmud would have gone? Mechamat mitzvah. And objects that are limited to an involvement with a particular mitzvah, I don't also pick up on Shabbat simply to pick it up on Shabbat. So if I have an etrog around... and it's used for the mitzvah of lulav, and I know I don't do it on Shabbat. Yeah, I don't touch it because of that, but I also don't touch it on Shabbat 3 weeks later if my etrog is still sitting somewhere because it's used specifically for a different mitzvah.
What about the pointer?
The yad I can always pick up. Yad's the tool that I actually use on Shabbat for a Shabbat purpose for Kriyat HaTorah, and therefore totally permissible. So, you can shake this board, and if the lamp is extinguished, it's extinguished. That's the rabbis of the Braita. Amri devei Rabbi Yanai, those of the Academy of Rabbi Yanai, said, Lo shanu ela bishocheach The rabbis taught that one may shake off the lamp and carry the board only in the case where one forgets and unintentionally leaves that lamp on the board before the Sabbath. Aval, but b'manich nasa basifas of arasur, where one intentionally leaves the lamp on the board to be there for the Sabbath, the board has become a base for a forbidden object. And like the tray that I told you about with my wallet, so the board is the basis, and now muktza, it's the base for the muktza that's on it. Then I have this, another situation. Tana, it was taught in a braita. Ner shachare adelet, if a lamp stands behind a door, poteach v'noel kedarko. One may open and shut the door in an ordinary way. What's the problem? I'm worried about the breeze. Now, either there's a little lamp that's hanging on the backside of my door, kind of like one of those little pieces that I have on literally the backside of my door. Two, the lamp is on a wall over here, and my door swings all the way, and it might smack it, so it's not, well, it could be the breeze, or it could be actually the smack. Or three, the lamp is in a place that's lit on my wall, that the breeze itself is the only potential for putting it out. So there's at least three different scenarios that the Rishonim come up with for what, where this thing and how this scenario works. The im kavta kavta, and if the flame is extinguished, it's extinguished. So I get to open the door. That's the braita. Oh, but what happens? Rav, what does he do? Layet ala Rav. Rav condemns the ruling. Anyone who rules according to this braita, Rav says, not the way to go, guys. It's a very interesting, Talmudic kind of piece of the discussion. Because in general, what's the status of a braita? What have you heard over the years, right? Braitas are so essential. Braitas, Tanaitic teachings, are what's going to trump sometimes the Amoraic stance after a lot of good legal reasoning. In this case, Rav comes and says about it that really, it's not the way to go. The Gemara explores the reason for Rav's reaction.
What is he specifically rejecting?
It's a good question. It's a good question. So, what was interesting about that question that you're asking, what is he specifically? So, Rav would discourage and say that it really wasn't following the right halacha if you opened the door and you extinguished the candle. It's all about the extinguishing. And so it's that here the candle behind the door, there are different interpretations of the statement, as I said to you, about the physical kind of way that this is happening. And then listen to this note that Steinsaltz wrote. If there is a kindled lamp behind the door, it is prohibited to open the door in the usual manner because it might extinguish the flame. The same applies to a window as well. This is according to Rashi's interpretation of the opinion of Rav, that I've got to open this door differently if there's such a situation. If the lamp is set into the wall behind the door, and when open, the door will bang into the candle and extinguish it, one must open and close the door gently so that it doesn't touch the candle. That's the Rosh, based on Rabbeinu Hananel and the Rambam. If the candle is set into the door itself, it is prohibited to open and close the door. So if it's really on the back of the door, I can't swing it. So in order to understand what Rav is really saying, we have to understand what Rashi's holding and what the Rambam and Rabbeinu Hananel are saying. So that's Steinsaltz's point in making that note. Rav just says, can't be done if it's on the back of the door, and it's got to be done differently if it's otherwise. Now, going back, the Gemara explores the reason for Rav's ruling.
So is it okay to open and close the door?
Yeah.
Yes, but not to make the...
Yeah. Amar le Ravina le Rav Acha Barei de Rava. Ravina says to Rav Acha, the son of Rava, Va'amri le Rav Acha Barei de Rava, Ravashi, and some say it was Rav Acha, the son of Rava, who said this to Ravashi, My tama layet ala Rav. Why did Rav condemn the ruling? E lema mishum de Rav savar la k'Rav Yehuda. If you'll say it's because Rav holds in accord with Rav Yehuda, who says that an unintentional act is prohibited. The Tana katane la k'Rav Shimon. Whereas the Tana in our Mishnah taught that the Braita is in accordance with Rav Shimon, who maintains that an unintentional act is permitted. How can that be? Mishum d'Rav Savar la ka Rabbi Yehuda, because Rav sides with Rabbi Yehuda. Kol d'tanik Rabbi Shimon melat layitle. And that is that a reason for him to condemn anyone who teaches a braita in accordance with Rabbi Shimon? What did Rabbi Shimon and our braita say again? You can use the cover and have the unintentional act be an indirect result. So if it's according to Rabbi Shimon, then it wouldn't make sense. Because Rav is saying here, what? You can't do it. He cursed anyone who went according to this position that im kavta kavta. If the fire is extinguished, it's extinguished. The Gemara responds, Amar Leh, says to him, Baha, if you Rabbi Shimon odeh. In this instance though, even Rabbi Shimon concedes, Daha Abai v'Rava da'amei tarvaihu, because Abai and Rava both said what? Mode Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon concedes, Bifsik resha v'lo yamut, that one is liable in the case of an inevitable consequence. Thus, the Braita is at odds with both Rabbi Yehuda's and Rabbi Shimon's opinions, and Rav therefore condemned anyone who follows its ruling. So in this case, Rabbi Shimon is saying, Pasik resha v'lo yamut. What does that mean? Look on the back of the handout I gave you. And this gets into, right, literally, cut off its head. A shortened form of the rhetorical question, if its head's cut off, will it not die? This expression is used to describe the inevitable consequence of an action. In many instances, particularly with regard to the Sabbath laws, a person is not liable for the forbidden but unintended results of certain actions. This exemption from liability applies, however, only if the forbidden result is possible but not, what? Inevitable. If the result is inevitable, one cannot claim that it was unintentional, just as one cannot claim that one merely wanted to cut off an animal's head, but had no intention of killing it. So, where does it come from? Two possibilities. One of the sources I read about the concept said that children like to play with the feathery body of a chicken. One that couldn't be used for whatever reason.
If they had feathery
bodies? Yeah. And that if the chicken looked like one that a kid could play with and wanted to play with it, you know, and the somebody wanted to give the kid the chicken to play with and want to make a toy of it, well, how deal? Like, I guess they did something with the feathers and then they plucked them, and I have to, I really need to look into that one a little bit more as to understand really what was being said. But that, what, are you going to cut off the head and it's not going to die? Seek ratio of a lo yamut. The other one is that there's a discussion of shechting on a Sabbath and not causing death to an animal. So somebody in their Talmudic logic says, wait a minute, are you telling me on a yantiv that you can actually shecht the chicken? Well, I need it to have for my yantiv meal. Therefore, I can shecht it and cut off its head, and therefore it becomes my ocham nefesh, the food that I need for the holiday, and I haven't really caused death to the chicken. I've just shechted my chicken to make the joy of the chag. Someone comes along and says, seek resh v'lo yamut. You know, if you want to go with the principle that you're really not allowed to cause any death, then, you know, don't tell me you're cutting off its head and it's not going to die. This is a rhetorical, then, phrase that recurs to say, are you really going to open this door and you think you're not going to put out the flame? In this case, it's not just possible, it's inevitable. We know the physics, we know the reality of a candle burning, of a lamp burning, and the breeze that's going to be created. Obviously, there are some Rishonim who thought that if it was set up in the right way, one could open the door in a way that did not cause that. But for the parlance here, it is about the potential actions that I take and that which I either intend or I don't. I got the second side from this volume. There is one down there as well in the English set of Steinsaltz Talmudim. This is a reference guide. This is the one volume that's the reference guide in the set. Steinsaltz edition of the Talmud, the Koran, this new one that I've also been reading from in terms of the translation and doing Daf Yomi, and this reference guide was just published in this style. I'm wondering if there are more extensive notes. I haven't looked at it yet. I don't know. So when it comes to this area of inquiry about a Pesik Reisha, there's also the principle Devar She'eino Mitkaven, a thing that which you don't intend, or an action which you don't intend. And I just want to read you that entry, which I didn't copy for you. I did copy the Pesik Reisha. Devar She'eino Mitkaven, an act done unintentionally. A prohibited act committed unintentionally while performing a permitted act. With reference to the Sabbath prohibitions, a person is not liable if he unintentionally carries out a forbidden act of labor while performing a permitted act, except where the permitted act is such that it must of necessity bring about a violation of the Sabbath laws. See Pesik Reisha. With reference to other prohibitions, there is no punishment for their unintentional violation while performing a permitted act.
So I find this really fascinating because it means by the time this is formulated, despite the fact that there's a God who can intervene and do any miracle, fundamentally they've adopted a deterministic view of inevitability. And that's, I find, really interesting, because it seems to move God out of the ability to intervene miraculously.
Well, I think that's a major extrapolation, philosophically, from where we are with the prat of opening a door and extinguishing a candle. But I find it, it's definitely, any of these are a pit front pay barry, an open door to really fundamentally take a look inside their minds.
And the second,
could be.
And the flip side is, we would, in science, we use the term stochastic, meaning mm-hmm. probabilistic. So it's really interesting to me to convert this notion of unintended into a notion of probability. And at what point do you reach that critical level where the level of uncertainty is at 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,
right,
that it's okay to do that?
That to me is closer to what they're grappling with than I think the determinism that could fill the world. But I wonder whether or not they're trying to implant within us this balancing act of knowing for sure and being confident, and then otherwise acting in the world, figuring that it is only possible and not entirely inevitable. That I think they are asking us to weigh. As people,
Shabbos going to come in and open.
Well, that's a whole different story. In a Mishnah or two, this is my advertisement. In a Mishnah or two, this becomes a major, major part of our chapter about who's doing the act and whether or not we can reach out and ask, and what that whole area of law winds up with, here in our chapter. You had a. How so?
So it wasn't prohibited, and it unintentionally broke, and it wasn't inevitable that it breaks.
Right, that may be why. Right, that may be why he permits it.
So is this discussion about the candle or the lamp, is this based on the temptation to want to conserve oil or conserve a candle? Because these are very limited resources in the home. So, if you can kind of make the candle go out before it burns down, but it's an accident, it's okay. Is that part of what's going on?
That gets us into definitely an economic management of what's going on, so that it could very well be from an economic standpoint that some of this discussion is happening.
The temptation would be,
right.
Oh yeah.
Overfilled the oil lamp.
The candle here when you open the door.
Yeah.
At night, it goes out.
Overfilled the oil lamp, when you put it there, from the get go, thinking about, you know, some people, my child is only three now, I'll leave the light on up there, and since he's only three, and I know that from ages 0 through 5, I can kind of pick him up and he can use his pinky and shut off the switch, we'll leave that light on for tonight, you know, make him feel good about going to bed with the light on. So there is some element within Jewish law of playing within the system to do what's either economically a better, more feasible or more reasonable outlook, but I wouldn't say it's a what's called lechatchila, from the get-go calculation. I don't know if it's as get from the get-go, but in the moment, you know, perhaps.
So I read this well. If it's extinguished, it's extinguished. Okay.
Yeah.
No, don't worry about it.
I'm struck by the difference between what's being said here and in our common law system. And it's a rule of black-letter law that a person intends the natural and probable consequences of his actions. Not inevitable, but natural and probable. I would think that this would seem to, and then it's often said, you can't have a pure heart and an empty head. I mean, if it's probable that something's going to follow, you are held to intend it. This would seem to set, as it were, a lower standard. You could say, well, I really didn't intend it. And as long as it's not inevitable, even if it's likely, you're excused. That seems an odd, when you're talking about observing the rules of Shabbat, that seems an odd indulgence. To allow somebody to be in effect stupid, but unless it's just inevitable, I mean, it's to a near certainty.
Right. Words,
that distinction between probability and inevitability, I don't know why this Shabbat law should be more indulgent than, you know, just the general rule that if something's likely to happen, then you intended it to happen.
Right.
Because the penalty is death.
We learned that if by mistake I take a pen and I write one letter, I'm not allowed to write the other letter. And that's okay. So double act is not good, one act is okay. So here we have one act, so why not to do it?
An interesting potential of application of another principle to this place. They didn't apply it. It's definitely, that's part of the discussion like Rishonim have. Let me end up with the more 18th, 19th century as promised. What did the people in the Muslim movement do with this? Seek resha v'lo nichabe. So there's a value in the ethical movement and in the character building movement to say that yosher, straightforwardness and honesty, is a great policy, right? And I want to absolutely share with you that I'm upset with you. I think you're wrong. I have a different way of doing this. And I'm going to be yosher. I'm going to do it, right? Even delivered in the right way, a person should think, seek resha v'lo yamut. If I chew his head off, will he not die somewhat of a death? How to deliver that message? How to speak to one another? How to be honest, yet to be kind and not take life, but to add life? This is the Musar message. This is the ethical message that came out from one small principle. And there are people who sometimes work on taking these small principles of halachic discourse and legal discourse and move them into a world of interaction among human beings in an ethical way, so that there can be the application of such principle in our daily interaction. So, Lala Tov.
Thank you.